Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering radiation cancer treatment from over 30 physicians at 20 locations in the Charlotte regional area. Details at treatcancer.com.
Hey, y'all, I'm Tommy Tomlinson, and from WFAE in Charlotte, this is Southbound. Webb Hubble was a political prodigy. When he was just 29, he became mayor of Little Rock. A few years after that, he was Chief Justice of the Arkansas Supreme Court. And a few years after that, he was heading to Washington to serve under his friend, President Bill Clinton. But his fast rise was followed by a hard fall. He got caught having overbilled clients at his law firm back in Little Rock. He served prison time for that. And he was also caught up in the Whitewater investigation that dogged the entire Clinton presidency. Now, 25 years later, Webb Hubble lives in Charlotte, and he's settled into a second career of writing legal thrillers. It's fair to say he knows a lot about legal issues and a lot about thrills, the good kind and the bad. Here's our conversation. So, Webb Hubble, I wanted to ask you, first of all, about Arkansas.
Yeah.
Born and raised there, right?
I was born in Little Rock and raised there, went to high school and went to college there.
Yeah. So you mentioned somewhere in your autobiography about this notion of an Arkansas inferiority complex.
Yes.
And could you kind of tell me what you're talking about there?
Well, I think if you grew up in Arkansas, you were always aware that we were either last or next to last to just about every other state in every category. You know, we used to say, thank God for Mississippi, because
lots of southern states have said that, right?
Lots of southern states say that. And also, we always had, you know, we were next to Texas. And certainly, if you played football in Arkansas, you were in the old Southwest Conference. And Texas was this giant state that for some reason always beat you. So you had this just complex that there was something a little bit different about Arkansas. And I think it drove a lot of people to success because of that inferiority complex.
Maybe you could help settle a question for me that I've had for a long time. Arkansas, to me, clearly feels like the South.
Absolutely.
You know, and now it's part of the SEC in sports, all that sort of thing. Is Texas the South?
Texas is its own world. Well, so is Louisiana, too, and we sit next to one and on top of the other. But Arkansas is really the South.
Okay. So I want to just talk about this just briefly. You played football at Arkansas.
That's correct.
And you were drafted in the NFL by the Chicago Bears.
That's correct.
And didn't play because of a knee injury, right?
I got hurt my first game my senior year, and I was so smart. I played on it for the next 14 weeks.
Offensive lineman, right?
Offensive lineman, and tore it up just about every week.
Yeah.
And then when I got to the Bears, they knew about the injury, but I had a future if it would heal, but unfortunately it didn't.
So I want to ask, in at least one of your novels, it's about partly about football. There's a football player who's sort of the accused murderer in this book. But along the way, you talk about the effects of football and concussions and injuries and that sort of thing. And I guess it made me wonder if you have any second thoughts about your football life.
I don't have any second thoughts about it. And I don't think many of my teammates have second thoughts, although we have several teammates now going through concussion-related injuries to the point where he can't do anything. He can't work. He can't leave his house, actually. And it's very sad. And I see it in several other teammates that I have, a couple that went on to play pro ball, but several who played ball. So I think we don't regret playing, but I bet you a lot of us would not let our children play football.
So what made you decide to write legal thrillers?
Well, I'm having a great time doing it. What made me decide is I had a liver transplant 8 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And we decided after the transplant, and it was successful, that it was time to leave D.C. It hadn't been that great for us, to say the least. And we started looking around. We have two daughters who went to Davidson, and we ended up in Charlotte. Loved it. But I had to have something to do. And so I started, you know, a new career writing novels. And legal thrillers comes naturally because I'm a lawyer. And I'm a Southerner, so I tell stories all the time. And so it was just a natural. And I was fortunate enough to find a publisher, and I'm having the time of my life.
Now, was this something you had thought about doing earlier in your life, or this just kind of come to you in this phase?
It just came to me in this, you know, I think all of us, you know, a lawyer's been telling stories all his life. So that's nothing new. But I never had any desire to write a novel till I looked around, and what can you do at my age? And I thought, well, let's try this one.
Well, I know that this fiction, and I know I'm not even supposed to look at any character and say, oh, that reminds me of somebody. Yeah. However, your hero, Jack Patterson, yeah. is, you know, I want to use the sort of comic book phrase, a mild-mannered antitrust attorney who seems to get himself in all sorts of scrapes and involved in chaos and intrigue and in the middle of scandals and all. And I wonder if you see any parallels with your own life.
Well, I think all fiction is a little autobiographical. So certainly I see that. But I have a lot of lawyers back in Arkansas whose names are Jack, and every one of them thinks I've modeled the book after him. You know, so I think you take life in writing fiction, you take life as you know it. You write about something you know. And then you go from there, and there's going to be characters that look a lot like real people.
When you were a young, mild-mannered lawyer coming out of Arkansas, yeah. was politics something that you were thought you would be interested in or involved in someday?
Not at all. Not at all. I was fortunate enough to do well in law school, so I got a good job with the oldest law firm west of the Mississippi in Little Rock. And so I thought I'd just go practice law and about 40 years later retire. Had no inkling of politics, no inkling of writing novels, no inkling of doing anything other than practicing law.
And if I remember right, you sort of backed into politics. Somebody asked you to serve on the city board or something. Make sure I got that right.
Yeah, I was young and starting to practice law, and a good friend of mine was on what we call the city board. City council would be the same thing here in Charlotte. And he said, Webb, we've got a vacancy. And in Arkansas, if you have a vacancy on the city board or city council, the council itself appoints until the next election. And he said, Webb, we want you to put your name in. I said, why do that? And he said, well, it'll help you in your legal career, but don't worry, we won't appoint you. And I said, oh, that sounds pretty good. And I said, why? He said, well, we have an all-white male city board right now, and we've got to appoint an African-American. So I went through the process, got some good publicity, had to convince my partners that I was not going to go be a politician. And they called me the day of the vote, and he said, Webb, come on down, be sworn in. And I said, no, wait a minute. You promised me I wasn't going to get it. And he says, well, you did so well. We had another board member resign as well. So we had two vacancies. So we appointed you and a woman named Lottie Shackelford.
And then not too long later, a few years later, through some other kind of similar happenings, you ended up
In less than a year, the city board again, it's different, but the city board appoints the mayor. And we had a different mayor, and he got in a little bit of trouble. Said some things he shouldn't have said. So he resigned midterm, and they appointed me to be the mayor. So when I was still 29, I was mayor of Little Rock.
And then I actually skipped that part in my head because not too long after that, not too many years, you were Chief Justice of the Arkansas Supreme Court.
And again, another one of those circumstances where I was still on the city board at that time. The Chief Justice of the Supreme Court resigned. And again, unique circumstance that whoever the governor then appoints somebody to fulfill that term. And that person can't run for that position. So I got a call from Bill Clinton, and he said, Webb, we've got this vacancy. Why don't you take, 6 months off and go be Chief Justice? And so I did.
Yeah. So at that point, and you were
34 years old.
34. So at that point then, did you feel like your career had taken a sort of a permanent direction? Or did you feel like even then, when that 6 months was over, you were just going to go back and do what you've been doing?
I'm sure that at that time I had four kids who were starting to go through school, and I knew I had to go back and practice. You know, about 6 months now, it was a great 6 months. I loved being on the court, but I had to go back and work.
Looking back on that time now, yeah. Did you feel like that all happened like too soon for you?
Today I would tell you it probably did. You know, it was just so overwhelming. You were just so caught up in it. You know, those were financially not good decisions to make.
Because the jobs paid less than what you
were
making.
Well, in Little Rock, at that time, the city board paid nothing. It was a full-time, non-paying job. Mm. You had to have another job. And then on the Supreme Court, the salaries they were paying the judges back then were very minimal, like $40,000 a year.
And you mentioned Bill Clinton at that time. You guys had met just out of law school or right at the end of law school?
We actually met, I like this story, we actually met at the state mental hospital. And people's eyes get wide when I tell them that. And the truth is, that's where they gave the bar exam.
Right.
And that's kind of a fitting place to take the bar exam, is the state mental hospital. They had an auditorium, and so I met him then. A friend of mine introduced me, but I did not know him at that point. He and Hillary were going to go to Fayetteville and teach school, and so you got to know them a little bit, but not well. And then when he was elected attorney general 2 years after that, Hillary came with him, and she joined our law firm. And that's how I got to know the Clintons.
And so at the beginning, especially, you were closer to her than him,
absolutely.
Right?
At first, my relationship was with her, practicing law with her every day. And he was the attorney general, and we didn't have that much. And he was always on the road anyway.
And and another partner in your law firm was Vince Foster, of course.
That's correct.
Who'd become sort of his own tragic story down the road.
Yes.
Yeah. So describe to me, obviously, most people know this. The whole bunch of you got swept up and you made it to, you know, Bill Clinton gets elected and you all end up going to Washington together. Just try to describe what that time felt like to you.
Well, it was almost surreal, you know, and that's where partly where that inferiority complex comes in. You know, even when he was running, we thought, well, this first time he's running, he's just going to get his name out. George Bush at the time had a 90% approval rating. Bill Clinton was the Democratic nominee, but nobody really thought he was going to win. And then we got Ross Perot, and then the next thing you know, it looked like Bill Clinton's going to be elected president. We kept saying, no, that's not going to happen. We played Texas too many times to know what happens in the fourth quarter. You know? And so even that day before, the polls pretty well showed he was going to win, you still didn't believe it. And then all of a sudden it happened. And you know, the Clintons at that time didn't want to jinx it. So they had not done any preparation for transition or anything else. And then the next thing you know, the whole world's in Little Rock, Arkansas, you know, for the transition. He didn't have it in Washington, didn't have it anywhere else. Everybody had to come to Arkansas. And so we were having cabinet nominees like I said, the whole world came to Little Rock for about 2 months.
And then Little Rock started running the world.
And then Little Rock started running the world because, you know, I used to go Christmas shopping with Bill. It was just a tradition we did. And Christmas Eve, he called me and he said, "You still going?" And I said, "You're president. You're going to be president of the United States. You don't go shopping like normal people anymore." He said, "Oh, yeah, we're going." And so we went, and in the car, he asked me, he said, "You're coming to Washington, aren't you?" And I said, "Well, you want me to come?" And he said, "Yeah, you're coming with me. I don't know what I'm going to do with you yet, but you're coming." And that's how you get there. You kind of swept. It was just like a tidal wave. And, you know, my friend Vince and, of course, Hillary was going, and other people that I knew real well, we're going to be part of the administration, and I was one of them.
So I think you mentioned in your autobiography and kind of getting back to that Arkansas and inferiority complex idea, How did you feel like Washington was going to treat a bunch of Southerners coming in? And how did you feel like once you got there, did you feel any chip on your shoulder, any being dismissed at all because of your accent or any of that sort of thing?
It took a while to adjust to what I call the East Coast mentality.
Which
was that if you didn't go to the Ivy Leagues, you weren't living in Washington or on the East Coast, and I meant the Northeast Coast, not the Southeast Coast, not North Carolina or South Carolina, you really didn't belong. And, of course, Bill and Hillary had the advantage. They had gone to Yale Law School, and Bill had gone to Georgetown, and he knew everybody, and she knew everybody. But the rest of us were really basically Arkansans coming to Washington, and we did feel like, who are you? You know, where'd you go to school? And you'd say, Arkansas. Where'd you go to law school? Arkansas.
I got you. So I wonder this a lot about Southerners in all walks of life, you know, whether that feeling that we have among other people is real or if we just feel it in ourselves. Did you notice people explicitly sort of?
It was never explicit. And so it's probably halfway internal and halfway external. I think there is, after living in Washington I ended up living there much longer.
Right.
There is a definite East Coast mentality that dominates Washington and New York and a lot of other communities. It's, for example, you know, bankers still wonder, why is the banking industry centered in Charlotte? It drives them crazy.
It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. So it is real, but it helped you. You were driven a little bit. Well, I'll prove I'm exactly where I'm supposed to be.
Yeah. So as you get to Washington, and this is one of those things that, you know, a gifted writer might have put in a thriller.
Yeah.
You knew you had the secret back home.
Right.
That you were trying to hide. And that was that you had you had overbilled some clients back at your law firm in Little Rock to pay for some personal expenses.
That's correct.
And when that was happening, when you started doing that, did you feel like, I'm a lawyer, at some point, even if I get caught, I'm going to be able to talk my way out of this?
I don't think that was it. I think it was more of you were telling yourself, I'm going to figure out a way to make this right, you know, and you didn't talk to anybody except yourself, you know, and to some extent, most people shouldn't go to Washington to escape, but to a large extent, that's what I felt like I was doing. Okay. I'm going to Washington, I'm going to start over, and that's behind me. You know, I got away with it to begin with, and it won't follow me to Washington. And to some extent, it was an escape.
And did you feel like you had gotten away with it when you left? I mean, did you?
I never thought about that as being what I did was that wrong, but it was. I mean, what I did was wrong, and I paid a hefty price for it. And that's the way it was. But I didn't think I got away with it. I was just saying, okay, we're starting over, you know, starting a new life.
I know you describe in your autobiography just how overwhelming the workload was that you had to deal with.
Right.
You dealt with the Waco situation, David Koresh. You dealt with so many other things.
Yeah.
There were unfilled vacancies. The attorney general was unfilled for quite a while, that stuff. I'm setting all that up to say, because of all that workload, did those things that you knew were there back in Little Rock, did they sort of disappear?
They disappeared. I didn't even think about them. I mean, we were so overwhelmed with work. Like you said, the first raid at Waco and World Trade Center 1 happened the same weekend.
Yeah.
And we didn't have an attorney general. And I was the only political appointee at the Department of Justice. Those are the kind of days you would have. You know, and like you said, it didn't get any better. Everything is viewed from political eyes once you get to Washington. You learn that what you would do that might seem innocent is then examined under a political microscope. And you had to learn to adjust to that, you know.
Now, was that surprising to you when you got there? Had you been prepared for what that would be like?
I was not prepared for the political scrutiny that everything you did would come under. In Arkansas at the time when Bill Clinton was governor, we had about 90% of the legislature were Democrats. And the other 10% were just as good of friends with Clinton as the 90% Democrat. We just weren't at war with each other. You know, we might disagree on an issue, but we went and had a drink together afterwards, you know. And it took, I think for all of us, including the Clintons, it took some adjustment that, hey, we're not all in this together. You're going to be looked at pretty harshly. The Wall Street Journal ran 5 editorials about me because the fact I was the only political person there, and I hadn't gone through confirmation yet. And so they would run these editorials that say, who is Webster Hubble? You know, now I'm the only one who wasn't bothered by them because they did little dot drawings that made me look skinny. So I said, I kind of like
you'll,
this.
You'll take that, yeah.
I'll take this. But you learned pretty quickly that everything you did had to be looked at under a political microscope.
And do you remember the moment when you realized that your sins back home had sort of caught up with you?
It did. You know, I was just, like I said, even into the second year I was working, there was starting to be some turnover. Vince had died, of course, which was a tragedy. Some of Arkansas people had gone back home, and I was just, you know, we met with the Attorney General every morning, and we had a list of 200 things we were trying to accomplish. And then all of a sudden, I read in the paper one day that, you know, that I was under investigation. I went, oh
so
my.
So that's how you found out, was reading the newspaper?
And I had. You know, we had appointed the special counsel by then. It was not an independent counsel. It was Robert Fisk at first. And I had a lawyer who was answering some questions, but they weren't about the old stuff. They were about, actually more about the Clintons and Whitewater and Madison Guarantee Savings and Loan. And so I didn't think about it. All of a sudden, I'm reading the paper. I'm under investigation. And I call my lawyer, and he says, yeah, I've been meaning to talk to you. And, you know, I knew, and I resigned within a week. I knew what was coming, and not to the degree it was, but I knew that everything would be looked at and that it wouldn't be right for me to stay.
So you ultimately ended up serving 18 months in prison.
Right.
I noticed you got to take some books with you when you went to prison. And one of the books you took with you was Thomas Wolfe's You Can't Go Home Again.
That's correct.
That felt highly symbolic to me as I was reading it. I wonder why you chose.
Well, that was how I was feeling. You know, I had left, I had still a lot of friends and teammates, but that's kind of the feeling. I will never be able to go home again. You know, this is my world has changed. And, you know, I've loved my state. I loved the South. I loved Arkansas. And, you know, you had second thoughts of if I'd stayed at home, I think everything I wouldn't have ended up in prison. And that's probably true, but you can't. You learn over time. You can't undo things. You just have to deal with them.
And have you felt like since then? I mean, I assume you've been back to Arkansas.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But have you felt like that's just not a place you could live anymore?
I don't think it'd be fair to them, to some of them, to some of my old law partners. And I don't think it'd be fair to my family, you know. Believe me, I have tons of friends. I didn't serve in Vietnam because I couldn't. I was 4F. But football is to some extent a foxhole mentality. And when I got in trouble, first letters, first calls I was getting were my old teammates and coaches. You know, we know who you are. Don't, you know, this is just a bump in the road. Keep on going. So I have lots of friends still there. Mm-hmm. But I didn't feel like I could go back and work there.
Do you have people that you served with that you're still in touch with from prison?
A couple of them have died that I was really close to. You weren't officially supposed to be in contact with them after you left.
If they were still there.
Oh, no. Once they get out.
Oh, really? You're not supposed to stay in touch with
them? When you're on what is called supervised release or probation or parole or whatever they call it, you have to sign a form every month that says you haven't been in touch with anybody who's been a convicted person.
Oh, I see.
So you were not supposed to. Now, we would make a phone call or two. And since a lot of them were from the D.C. area, I would run into them. But now that I've been in Charlotte, I haven't had many of those people that I've been in touch with. A couple I have been in touch with that we were very close, what I call my sabbatical.
I guess that's one way to put it, yes.
And it was. I counsel people now. I have for the last 20 years on what it's like to go to prison. And one of the things I try to talk to them about is that it is a sabbatical. It is an opportunity to kind of reinvent yourself if you have the right attitude.
I was going to ask you, what things did you learn maybe about yourself or about life?
Well, you know, you have to examine what caused you to be there in the first place. What were your faults? And you certainly have time when you're in prison. That's the one thing you have plenty of. It helped me become a better person. I read a great deal, got in shape. You know, lost 70 pounds while I was in prison. I wish I'd kept it off. there's a lot of ways that it was very good for me.
I know you served in minimum security prison, which I think a lot of people think of as pretty easy time. what would you tell people about that sort of prison?
I would say, first of all, I think every member of Congress ought to spend a month there, and they wouldn't call it camp or anything like that. It is not. You're still locked up. Mm. And there's no country club atmosphere. You all have jobs. You're all away from your children and away from your families. There's no conjugal visits. If your spouse comes and visits you, you know, she has to be searched and you have to be searched. And all those things that are humiliating are there. Now, because the special prosecutor was still investigating everybody, I had to go to more secure facilities. I spent the night in Fulton County Jail and spent the night in Oklahoma City and spent a week in a closet outside of Arkansas.
So is that what you were being transported to testify?
Testify or to answer questions in a congressional investigation. I would spend the night in the D.C. jail. Those are not nice places. I wouldn't wish that on my worst enemy. So I had some experience with that. But the basic facility, the best thing I can tell people who are about to go to a minimum security facility is the people that are there don't have any violence in their background. And as long as you don't play basketball, you won't get any fights.
Yeah. I just thought of this, and maybe a kind of a strange question, but you know that feeling where you first wake up, I guess I get this feeling, especially when I'm on the road somewhere. Yeah. And those first 10 seconds when you wake up, you're not quite sure where you are.
Mm-hmm.
Do you ever wake up and all of a sudden you wonder if you're back there or not?
I certainly dream about being back there or being locked up.
So what are those dreams like?
They're not nice. You know, it is not fun. But every now and then you'll wonder where you are, but it's more dreaming than waking up.
When we come back, Webb Hubble talks about the parallels between where he found himself 25 years ago and where President Trump finds himself now. That and more ahead on Southbound.
Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com. Hey, Southbound fans. What Charlotte issue do you want to hear more about? What questions would you ask the mayor? Now's your chance. Each month, Charlotte Mayor Vi Lyles joins Mike Collins on WFAE's Charlotte Talks for a discussion about the city's most important topics. You can submit your question for Mike and the mayor on Twitter at Charlotte Talks or email charlottetalks@wfae.org. While you're at it, you can find the Charlotte Talks podcast right now on NPR One and WFAE.org. All right, back to the show.
So you mentioned having to go testify in all these investigations, and I know you were investigated pretty thoroughly by Kenneth Starr along the way. And I guess it makes me think, first of all, I guess I should just stop and ask. My impression is, just from your background and all that, it would not strike me that you're a supporter of our current president. Is that fair
to say? I'm not a supporter of the current president.
Okay. But I guess I've, looking into your background, thinking about it, so you were pursued very thoroughly by a special prosecutor. Along the way, you felt like the FBI treated you pretty poorly in the way it investigated you and the way it asked questions and that sort of thing. So we now have a current president who is being pretty thoroughly investigated by a federal prosecutor, special prosecutor, and who feels like the FBI has treated him pretty poorly along the way. When you see him talking and tweeting about all this stuff, regardless of what you think about his politics, do you think in any way that maybe he has a point?
It's deja vu all over again. And I am not a fan of special counsels or the way the FBI interrogates people. So when this special counsel was appointed, I thought, oh gosh, no matter what you don't wish that on your worst enemy. And he is the president of the United States, and I hate it. I mean, I am not a supporter. I wish Hillary had been elected. I wish almost anybody had been elected other than the current president. But I don't wish him a special counsel because it's just a special counsel is designed to get the target. And he has unlimited funds. And for anybody in the world, and just about anybody in the world, if you give somebody unlimited funds and say, find a crime, as opposed to look for a crime and then find out who committed it, they look at the person they want to target and go search their life and find a crime. They're going to find a crime. And the hardest part is like when Kenneth Starr was there, we had 100 people who worked in the White House or government, who's had over $100,000 in legal bills. That's happening all over again. And it keeps the government from running.
So is there a better way to do it?
Oh, there's a lot better way to do it.
I mean, how?
Well, it depends on what you're looking at. You know, I think a nonpartisan investigation into the Russian interference would bring forth some interesting revelations.
I'm not as familiar with how the legal process would work as you. How, if you were setting something like that up,
Good example is 9/11.
Okay.
After 9/11, they created a nonpartisan 9/11 commission of people in public figures who'd served in government, former, you know, deputy attorney generals, former people in the military, things of that sort, who looked at 9/11 and came back with recommendations of how to prevent it from happening again. That worked, you know, and then the government can then adapt those. As opposed to that, we're out looking for crimes, you know. And then and then we'll deal with it. And people's lives will be destroyed. You know, I don't want to say nobody has done anything. I don't know.
Right.
You know, we're a year and a half into it, and we don't know. We've had a couple of guilty pleas, nothing to do with Russian tampering with elections yet. So I know I'm sounding like I'm on Fox News.
And
No, I'm definitely not.
But I thought this was interesting because I think you have a perspective on it that maybe a lot of people who are not Trump supporters would not have. So that's why I'm asking.
Yeah. I mean, you're in a situation if you're called to be interviewed by the FBI. If, you know, it's just you and an FBI agent and a yellow legal pad. Nothing's recorded. Mm. And so if they come back in court and say you lied, it's your word against the FBI. And I don't believe in that. I have too much experience with it. And there are lots of good, great people in law enforcement. Don't get me wrong. But there's things that I wouldn't let, if I were practicing law, I wouldn't let my client do. And one would be interviewed by the FBI unless it was recorded.
I want to ask about one other parallel, see, not to you personally, but to the Clinton administration in general. So we're having this conversation just a few days after the Stormy Daniels interview on 60 Minutes. You looked at me like you knew I was going to ask this question.
No, I didn't.
Well, first of all, did you watch that?
No, I did not watch it.
You have the gist of what's going on.
I do know what's going on. Yes.
So I find myself wondering, and I found myself wondering as I saw this, if one reason that President Trump has seemed so far to be able to slip out from under all these allegations against him is because of what happened with Bill Clinton and Monica Lewinsky and things that happened while he was in office. And I guess the question I'm circling around to is, do you think it's more difficult for, let's say, Democrats or at the very least people who are not Trump supporters to claim the moral high ground now because of what happened back then?
I think that's part of it. I think part of it is we look on things based on our political bias. And so Democrats stood by Bill Clinton and said sex is a private matter between a man and a woman, and hopefully the spouse has something to say about it. And that they say the same thing. So there is a little bit of hypocrisy. Different circumstances, different allegations.
Yep.
Again, I don't want to know. You know, this isn't my business. I do want to know how he's running the country. I don't care what happened 12 years ago between him and, as I didn't care about Bill Clinton and the allegations that were made 12 years earlier, things of that sort. Jennifer Flowers, for example, was...
I guess that's more of a parallel, right?
I think Jennifer Flowers is more of a parallel. Jennifer Flowers said, I had a 13-year affair, and yeah, people are going to be fascinated by sex. It's just the way the world turns.
Yeah.
But frankly, I think it takes away from the dignity of the office.
So what's your relationship with the Clintons these days? Are you guys still talk?
I do talk to the president, not often. He was in Charlotte for Billy Graham's funeral, and he called and said hello. I sent him my books, and he gives me a comment or two. Hillary was unique in that for the longest time, for that period that I was under investigation, which ended up being for 6 years. She was prohibited from talking to me because I was under investigation and she was under investigation. And one of the things Ken Starr was looking at is, are they telling Webb to keep quiet?
Yeah. Right.
So for 6 years, I couldn't talk to him. And then she was always running for office. And you advise people not to talk to felons or convicted persons if you're running for office, not to be seen with them. So for 25 years, she was running for political office, so I was persona non grata. So my relationship with her is not as good as it is with the former president.
So there were, in the last two elections, presidential elections, there were moments where she felt like she was clearly going to win.
Yes.
It looked in both, you know, before Obama became, you know, much more prominent,
yeah.
and then before Trump sort of captured the nation in whatever way he captured the nation. Yeah. So do you feel like those are just sort of unicorn moments where these two other politicians happen to capture the world in some special way? Or do you feel like there's something about her that made it difficult for her to win?
I think it's a combination of both. I mean, certainly Obama captured the imagination of the Democratic Party, and to say she thought it was hers. And all of a sudden, this guy who has no experience whatsoever is capturing enough votes to barely beat her. And I think at that point, it was a shock, you know. It was her turn. I think even more so when we look at what happened with Trump. I think it's still, she's having a hard time with it this time. I think the reality is that there's parts, she is, to me, she reminds me a little bit of Al Gore. Al Gore, one-on-one, personally, is one of the funniest, most engaging people I've ever met in politics. If he were in this room and no microphones, you would think, this is the most wonderful man I've ever met. Then you put the microphones up like we have right now, and all of a sudden he's a different person. The same way with Hillary. She doesn't come across media-wise like she does in person. And I wish some of that person in Al Gore could have come across, and I certainly wish it had been for Hillary.
And do you think that's just a natural sort of guardedness, or do you think that's people being advised to do that? Or,
a little bit of everything. I don't know where it comes from in Al Gore's case. I think a little bit it is a defensive nature. You know, a lot of it is she was a lawyer and she's used to, you know, being an advocate. It's hard to be an advocate for yourself.
As you talked about her and not being able to talk to her for so long, it also made me think of Vince Foster, who obviously was people may not know, a very close friend of yours,
yeah.
and then committed suicide not long after the administration
right.
began. And I guess I wonder if you feel like, you know, for those few years that, you know, things were going great and the administration come in, do you feel like that ended up being a net positive in your life or a net negative in your life? Or how do you judge all that now?
I, you know, the loss of Vince was a tragedy, certainly for his family and for all his friends, including me. I mean, I think we saw things going downhill after that point, mm-hmm. you know, and just the realization that he was suffering so much and he couldn't tell a soul. You know, I spent the weekend with him before he shot himself on that next week. And we talked about everything but that it was, you know, internally something was causing him to be so depressed. You can't look on life as a net plus or a net minus. It's who you are. It becomes who you are. People look and say, God, how awful prison was. Well, yes, it was. But at the same time, I'm who I am today. I can write about prison. I can write about what it's like. And it's part of me. And it's all in what you do with it after it happens. So I don't think it's a plus or minus. I just think it's who you are.
Now, I know you've told me at one point that you are part of a little group that talks about, has political discussions and that sort of thing here mm-hmm. in town. But I think you told me at one point you don't really talk about national politics that much, right?
Not that much. I mean, they want to. I don't want to talk about national politics. My wife wants to talk about national politics. And I'm having a hard time right now.
Do people look at you, though, and say, I mean, I guess I've done that some here yeah. today as sort of an expert or a—
Well, yeah. Yeah. And to some extent, I am. I mean, one of the things I love to talk about is the transition, which where we, you know, we went from Obama to Trump in 2 months.
Right.
The whole government changed. And it's still done peacefully, this time probably less peacefully than in previous administrations. But, you know, it's a fascinating process. How do you select a Secretary of State? What do you have to, what's that process that you have to go through? It's Supreme Court confirmations. I mean, I was, you know, advising Janet Reno when we selected Ruth Bader Ginsburg. I've still got a book of all the potential nominees, you know, during that period. And so in some ways I am an expert. In some ways I'm not anymore. Because I think the one thing that's still, I thought the partisanship was bad when I was there. And it was. But now it's a whole new world. I mean, it frightens me how partisan things are.
So I have to ask, so if Twitter had been around when Bill Clinton was president, would somebody have had to get him off of that too?
I think probably just because he's so engaging. He wants to engage. But, you know, the power, the biggest strength of Bill Clinton is what you alluded to. He could be in a room with 100 people, and before that night is out, he will have met every one of them. Look them in the eye, and every person will walk away thinking, he really cares about me. Now, the real secret is 5 years later, he'll meet, for example, you and say, Tommy, remember 5 years ago when we were in that room with 100 people and we talked about X? And you'll go, he did remember. He does know. You know, he had to, that was, it's an unbelievable gift.
So now, since you got out of politics, yeah, have you dabbled at all? Have you worked for any candidates or advised anybody? Or?
Well, one of the benefits of having been on sabbatical is no one will take your check.
Right.
And very few will.
So nobody's asking, right?
Nobody's asking. And so, I mean, I will maybe give some advice to the campaign manager or whatever, but I've not been dabbled at all, other than to contribute to a few people and make suggestions to others.
Do you have any itch ever to, like, something big's going on in the world and you wish you could be a part of
it? Oh, yeah, of course. Of course, you know, and you see things happen at the Justice Department or see things in national security that I dealt with, a lot of those issues. And you say, boy, for example, there's been a lot of talk about FISA, the FISA court.
Right.
Well, I used to have to read those reports. And so when people are talking about them and I know they're not saying what really happened, it drives me crazy. But there's nobody I can talk to and don't want to.
Yeah. So I guess I wonder if you ever thought, you're 70 now, is that right?
I'm 70.
What, when you were a young man, did you feel like your life would be like at 70? And how, has it, if at all, matched what you thought?
Well, certainly not. I had no idea. Like I said, even when I practiced law, you know, my thought was I'd practice for about 40 years and hopefully retire to a beach house and just watch the sunset every night. My life has not, I call it a journey without maps. You know, I've had some wonderful, tremendous experiences. I would never have put me in Charlotte writing novels at 70, yet there are not many 70-year-olds who can say they're having the time of their life, you know, and I am.
Yeah. It also strikes me that you had a huge roller coaster of, you know, you had a really fast, rapid ascent, then a really fast, pretty quick descent.
Right.
Now things have leveled off to an extent. Do you wish your life had been more level back along the way, or are you happy with the roller coaster?
The good part of my life is that I can't change a thing. You know, I've got to accept it as all a learning experience, you know. And so I can't change it, so what the heck, you know.
Good fodder to write with.
Absolutely.
Webb Hubble, thank you very much for talking to me.
Thank you for having me.
All right, my pleasure. Not long ago, before we taped this podcast, I spent a couple of hours with Webb Hubble in a Charlotte coffee shop. Nobody but me had any idea who he was. I got the sense he likes it that way. If you noticed in our conversation for the podcast, he was very careful not to say he wishes his life had turned out differently. He accepts that he did what he did, and other people did what they did, and there's no way to take any of it back. But I've met a lot of people who made it to the very center of their worlds, whether it's sports or politics or business or whatever. They were all drawn to that flame at the center, and they learned a little too late just how much it can burn you. I thought of the last episode of our podcast, the one we did with Dale Earnhardt Jr. He talked about how much he loved racing, while at the same time it made him miserable. I think Webb Hubble feels the same way about politics. And I think he's a lot happier now that he's a couple of steps back from the fire. Southbound is a production of WFAE in Charlotte. Our producer is Nick Della Canal. Our web manager is Jennifer Lang. Our audience engagement producer is Joni Deutsch. Our theme music comes from Josh Turner. If you have any thoughts about the show, ideas for future guests, or thoughts about whether Texas really belongs in the South, email me. I have a new WFAE email address now. It's T. Tomlinson, first initial, last name, at WFAE.org. You can listen to this and other episodes of Southbound on WFAE.org, iTunes, or wherever else you listen to podcasts. Also, between episodes, look for the Southbound Radio Hour with a playlist of music based on the most recent episode. You can find that on WFAE.org as well. See y'all next time. Thanks for listening.
Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, committed to technology-driven radiation therapy and treatments for cancer. Details at treatcancer.com.